How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
All right, Crossover NBA podcast, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck. Howard, I'm going to be in a little bit of a mood today. It's going to be one of those days because we are recording this episode a little bit later in the day than planned, in part because my flight from Philadelphia, where I was to watch Sixers-Blazers on Monday night, was delayed by 3+ hours there. You know, and look, Howard, we're no strangers to flights being delayed. That's part of the job. I get that. What I have a problem with is when the pilot or one of the flight attendants, when you're delayed, gets on the air and sounds overly cheery. We had to deplane in Philadelphia. And the pilot says, hey, go get yourself something to eat. Have a cup of coffee. We'll be right back with you as soon as we can. Like, fuck off. Like, seriously, that's my blunt takeaway. Like, just say, sorry, mechanical issue. We're working to fix it as soon as possible. End. Full stop. I don't need to have the go get yourself a sandwich. Like, nobody wants the deep plane to go to Sbarro. All right. That's not it, Howard. So that's how I feel about it.
There wasn't like a Geno's outlet to get a cheesesteak in the Philly airport. The airline couldn't have given you like just a pile of Biscoff to while away the time or something.
I don't want them to do that. I just want them to say, sorry.
Oh, I'll take the Biscoff.
Goodbye. Just be succinct. Don't be cheery. Don't smile at me when I'm getting off the plane. Don't do it. Thank God we're wearing masks because my face was contorted in a very angry way during that couple of hours there. But it's neither here nor there. We are back, and we have a lot to get into on today's show. I want to talk about the Celtics, of course, their kind of free fall. The Blazers, who I saw last night, they are not in a good place right now after back-to-back road losses. The Knicks, they're really good, and I think that's sustainable. But first, Howard, the hottest team in the NBA is the Chicago Bulls, who beat up on Boston with a ridiculous fourth quarter on Monday night, sitting atop the Eastern Conference standings, one loss on their resume. A guy that's going to help us with this conversation, Howard, is a man with no losses on his resume. He is undefeated in the beat writing journalism circles. He is Casey Johnson from the Chicago Tribune. Oh, from NBC Sports. Sorry, NBC Sports Chicago. So my fault, Casey. I'm used to saying Chicago Tribune with you, man.
It's all right, and we are living parallel lives. You woke up in Philly to go to Boston. I woke up in Boston to go to Philly. So good thing my flight made it on time. Thanks for asking.
Yeah, you got lots of smile. You're smiling right now because you're a nice, easy, hour-long flight to Philadelphia, and me, not so much. But
I think Casey is just generally cheerier than you, Mannix, so there's that.
That's distinctly possible, but I mean, like, I kind of define curmudgeonly at times. So, like, you know, I'm the embodiment of that word. So, yeah, I mean, it is what it is. All right, Casey, nobody saw this Bulls team coming. So at least nationally, we didn't see this Bulls team coming. They are top 10 in offense. They are top 10 in defense. You got DeMar DeRozan scoring, Zach LaVine scoring, Alonzo Ball doing a little bit of everything and defending. That fourth quarter, against Boston. It's a lot to do with dysfunction in Boston, but for Chicago to go, what was it, 35-9 in that fourth quarter at one point, and to hold Boston without a defensive rebound, which like never happens. I mean, it's been like a decade or decade and a half since something like that has happened, was really remarkable by the Bulls. So how much is this early start, and in what ways is it exceeding your expectations?
It's exceeding my expectations just in terms of how few losses they have. I mean, you can say it's preseason basketball, but it's a whole new collection of players, and they went 4-0 in the preseason too. So they're 10-1 to start the season with a whole new collection of players. What's not exceeding my expectations is style of play, because you saw it from game one. It's, you saw a bunch of guys kind of, you know, and DeMar DeRozan was on this point very early. What you see, what I saw from the Bulls from the offseason moving into the preseason was a collection of guys that have done a lot individually, but other than Caruso, who obviously won a championship with the Lakers, and DeMar's one trip to the conference finals, have not done much collectively. And DeMar kept saying, we got a bunch of guys with chips on their shoulders. And DeMar was, you know, firing back at how he's not a fit with Zach LaVine, you know, at his introductory news conference in August on Zoom. Mm-hmm. So it's just, it kind of had the right vibe going into preseason. And then you just saw it like right from the jump. They're undersized. Billy Donovan owned that right from the start as well. But they just are very tenacious defensively. They get in passing lanes. They block shots. They swarm the ball. They get steals. And then offensively, you know, I've been one of Zach LaVine's biggest defenders for a long time because I've seen the growth he's shown. And also, I've never bought into his empty calorie score label because I think he's a very selfless player at heart and wants to win. And you add Nikola Vucevic to that mix, very unselfish score. You add DeMar DeRozan to that mix, very unselfish score. You add Lonzo Ball to that mix, arguably one of the most unselfish players in the entire league, along with his brother. It's just a good collection of guys. So the style of play is not surprising me. The fact that they're 10-1 day in the preseason, you're right, no one saw that come.
And could be undefeated if not for kind of gagging against the Knicks. They should have won that game, arguably. So they're, as we speak, 7th overall in offensive efficiency, 6th overall in defensive efficiency. That profiles to a contender if that were to sustain, but we are very, very early, and this is small sample size theater. Which of those, KC, do you think is more likely to sustain at close to that level, the top 10 offense or the top 10 defense?
You know, it's funny because I never bought into the theory that there was going to be massive defensive struggles, just because if you look at Billy Donovan coach teams, he always gets his teams to defend. And he did it with very disparate and different personnel in Oklahoma City. I mean, that team that he had his fifth year, obviously, was completely different from the team he got in his first year. He had 4 top 10 defenses in his 5 seasons with the Thunder. So, and that obviously dates to his dominance on the college scene as well. He gets teams to defend. The Bulls finished 12th last year with a bunch of, you know, young unproven players and disjointedness and a midseason trade, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, I'm not sure. Like you guys aren't as old as me, but you are oldish. So
I am.
it's like I do. I'm a traditionalist. I like size, right? And the Bulls don't have any. I mean, although we'll get into Tony Bradley, or maybe we don't have enough time in the pod to get into Tony Bradley. Although Tony Bradley's already had a podium game, I just want to point that out. So, they don't have a lot of size, so that does concern me. But Billy just gets teams. He shapes his defense around his personnel, and he gets teams to defend. I do think that offensively, if I had to pick one, that's probably going to sustain just because you've got 3 all-star scorers. But Billy also said, like, look, I'm not surprised defensively we're ahead of where we are offensively, because when you have a bunch of new players who are in different roles, all these guys were, you know, the number one option on their teams, and now they're coming together to try to form their new identity. That's why he's not surprised that the defense has been slightly ahead of the offense.
The offense, they've got some great individual scorers, of course. Zach LaVine headlines. And I'm with you too, Casey. I hate the empty calories kind of phrase that's attached to guys. Like, I watched Andre Drummond last night just beat the daylights out of Yusuf Nurkic. And, like, Drummond gets hit with that constantly. But, you know, rebounds got to be collected by somebody. He often gets them. So I, like, you know, LaVine, he's a great scorer. What surprised me a little bit, in addition to that top 10 defense, is there, I think, third in the league in three-point shooting at this point. They're putting up some eye-popping numbers from some of these guys. Like Alex Caruso, I think he's shooting close to like 50%. DeRozan, not known
right.
as a three-point shooter, is over 40% from three-point range. You got Ball close to 40. Go down the list. I mean, Levine's at 35. Do you look at the when you look at those numbers, what do you see?
I see a team that's working to get the best shot. And I didn't check after last night. Their percentage has been high, but their attempts have not been that high. I haven't checked the last couple of games. So their attempts have not been as high. And, you know, DeMar obviously is the king of the mid-range. But what I see is a team that's, just like I said before, very unselfish and working to get the best shot. They don't care who carries the load offensively. They know they've got a lot of weapons and firepower. But, yeah, I mean – Levine is, to me, become an elite shooter in this league. I mean, if you looked at his splits last year, they were ridiculous, and he's darn near close to him again this year, even though he's playing through a thumb injury now that's on his guide hand, but he still doesn't look totally right, and he says he's going to try to play through these torn ligaments.
Let me ask you, what do you hear about that? Because that, you hear torn ligaments, you like play through, like it feels like there's a clock on that. Like this, you know, one, you know, good twist one way on a bad, you know, catch or something happens on the court, which is not only possible, but I would think probable at some point during the season. I mean, is he in a way a ticking time bomb? What do the Bulls say about the potential for further injury?
I mean, Billy said it after the Utah victory. He said this is just me personally. He doesn't look like himself. But, I mean, his numbers have been fine the last three games. He didn't shoot it well initially in Boston, but then he rallied to have a strong finish and kind of ride the ship in the third quarter for him. But you're right. I mean, it's to me, it's a fluid situation. He said he's going to play through it. He's got it heavily taped. You can see it's affecting his left hand ball handling for sure. Occasionally on drives, he's kind of maybe being a little bit more dominant right hand when he's always been comfortable switching hands near the cup. So it's an ongoing storyline for us for sure. If there is an extended absence, I mean, the Bulls are already dealing with two of them, and Coby White, who has yet to make his debut, and now Patrick Williams is lost likely for the regular season. So it's pretty remarkable what they're doing, given all that they've endured at this point.
Quick footnote, since we were discussing the three-point shooting, and then I'll veer away from this. But the Bulls are actually last in the league in three-point attempts at 27, which not that long ago probably would have led the league. So they're actually last in attempts and 26th in three-pointers made per game. So they're not exactly leading a three-point revolution, even though they are shooting at a nice percentage. So that makes me wonder a little bit about keeping up offensively, but we'll see. I'm more curious about this kind of big-picture look, Casey, ever since Arturas Karnasovas got there with his group, which it's only been a little over a year, really. But they've been super aggressive and going away from what was kind of the, hey, we're young and building and improving and we'll see it. Nope, you're all gone. We're bringing in Vucevic, which did not exactly pay off short term. And then bringing in, you know, obviously Lonzo Ball's a younger veteran, but a veteran. DeMar DeRozan, an older veteran. And so it seems like there's an implied urgency. They are on a four-year playoff drought. They haven't won a playoff series since 2015. Is that the proper read of this? Like that there was, whether it was from ownership or just from the new front office, where it was like, okay, time to stop farting around and waiting for youth to blossom and all this. Now we just got to start winning, which is kind of, the mirror is kind of what the Knicks did when Leon Rosen-Tibbs arrived. Is that the right read of this?
100%. And I've actually said this to Arturas jokingly he came in and he said like, he said, like, my job was to kind of assess and evaluate the roster. As everyone remembers, obviously, first of all, we have to put it into context. He was hired during a pandemic, right? So there's that. Then, you know, he knows that ownership has a good relationship with Jim Boylan. So he took his time making that decision. And then all he did that first season was draft Patrick Williams and sign Garrett Temple. And the fan base is like, why did we get new management? He didn't make any changes. And I'm painting with broad brushes, obviously, but you know, that was kind of the general vibe of a vocal vibe of the fan base. And then we get to the March trade deadline and boom, Nikola Vucevic. And so your read, Howard, jives with mine. And I'm joking. And he said this, Arturas, basically he got to the end of the evaluation period. He's like, I don't like any of you guys. You know, I mean, because look at it, like all that's left from the roster he inherited are Coby White and Zach LaVine. And You know, here's the other thing, like, because as we also know, and we're off on a lot of tangents here, but the fan base also, a vocal contingent of the fan base was tired of John and Gar, right? But I always point this out, like, because I was there for when John replaced Jerry Krause. He did the exact same thing. He flipped that entire roster in two seasons, except for Eddie Curry and Tyson Chandler, and built that kind of fun, try-hard Bulls team around Heinrich, Gordon Dang, Nocioni, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, John had a period where he was just as aggressive as Arturas is being, Arturas and Mark Eversley are being. But your reads, absolutely. And to me, it's just, I mean, obviously ownership wants to win, but they hired this guy and gave him a long-term contract to do what he wants. And he, my take on it was just, so he's like, this ain't working. So let's do it. And you can see what I like about their plan is if you look at two, they address specific needs. So Vucevic gave them not only another all-star caliber player, combo scorer, but a very good passer, unselfish player, can run offense through him, makes Coby White better in catch and shoot situations, takes, you know, responsibilities off his plate. Okay, then you get to the offseason. The Bulls were last in the league in free throw attempts last year, 27th in turnovers. Boom, here comes DeMar DeRozan. What does he do? He gets to the line, he doesn't turn the ball over. Caruso doesn't turn the ball over much. Ball. You know, it's like they address specific needs. As of today, they're third in the league in turnovers per game. I didn't check their turnover rate, but I know it's good. And I believe tied for eighth in free throw attempts per game. So they just, like, they're aggressive, but they're aggressively targeting specific needs that this team has had over the last couple of years.
Man, you think the Lakers would take Alex Caruso right now? I would think so. I would think they could use a player like that. What's your read, Casey, on – like Zach LaVine and this team, I'll be a free agent next year. Do you look at it as a kind of foregone conclusion, or is, you know, how this team plays this year going to be impactful for a player who before this season hasn't won anything really?
I mean, that's a good question, Mannix, possibly your first, but I would say,
I try.
I don't think that last one has as much to do with it. I just, you guys, I've been around the league too long enough. You never say never. I don't know if foregone conclusion is the right thing. I'm working under the operating assumption that he's going to be back. And here's why. Not only, you know, does he like Billy Donovan and Arturas Karnišovas and Mark Eversley in the direction of the franchise, the Bulls can pay him the most money, obviously. If he makes all NBA this year, they're the only team that can give him the Supermax. And more importantly, he was consulted on all of these moves. And that's, you know, he knew exactly what the Bulls were doing. He knew they had the opportunity to do the renegotiate and extend this summer. He was all on board with these moves, knowing, you know, obviously he's probably going to be taken care of down the road, which is next summer. But you guys know in this league, you never say never. So I don't want to make any, like, you know, headline statements here, but I personally, this is my take, would be surprised if he is elsewhere next season.
A quick follow-up to that, though, because the last time we thought they had a guy that who was a potential franchise player that they were going to build around, they traded him for Zach LaVine. That was, of course, Jimmy Butler. So how certain are we in this case? Obviously, different player, different situation, different front office. How convinced are you, Casey, that Zach LaVine is the guy they want to build around and intend to build around, assuming that he does want to re-sign that max or supermax next offseason?
Yeah, another big difference beyond all the ones you point out, Howard, is I mean, they burned a lot of draft capital to build this roster. So, I mean, they have to be, you know, wanting to resign Zach LaVine because they're not doing it through the draft anymore. They're out a lot of picks as it is. And then we're still waiting on the league's ruling on the Lonzo Ball investigation. And I don't know if that's going to burn more draft capital or not. I'm not going to speculate on that, but so that would be my read on that. And then as a quick aside, I would say that the local perception of the Bulls wanting to build around Jimmy Butler probably didn't square with the national perception because, I mean, John Paxson, I think he was trying to trade Jimmy the year before for Chris Dunn when he went to the Celtics. He was trying to trade with the Celtics to get up to get Chris Dunn the year before. And then that didn't work out. So they waited a year and then made the draft day deal with the Timberwolves. So,
man, everybody wanted Chris Dunn back in the day. Now, not so much.
Is he in the league? I got
No, he was waived, I believe, by Memphis. So.
Yeah, that's rough, yeah, man.
Yeah, man. I remember Jaylen Brown got booed on draft night because the fan base in Boston wanted the Providence College guy, Chris Dunn. I think that worked out okay for the Celtics. Last thing for you, Casey, off the current topic, but we were sort of chatting about this off air. Scottie Pippen's got a book out. I know we haven't read it yet, but some of the excerpts have been published. I guess from what you've seen, both from Scottie publicly and the little snippets you may have read, like, as someone that's covered the Bulls since, like, Guy Rogers was there, like, what's been your reaction to what Scottie's kind of been doing here?
Yeah, my reaction today with the excerpt I read about, you know, this in GQ, I guess, that the excerpt of the book, you know, where he's going at, he goes in on MJ and also on Pax. My reaction is exactly similar to when I was watching The Last Dance. And it's like, I feel like we're relitigating stuff that happened, like, you know, 25 years ago. And, you know, it was weird watching The Last Dance because, you know, especially with social media, people were acting like all this stuff was news. And I'm like, you know, no, we reported all this like 25 years ago. This is like not news. But also just kind of this feeling of like oddness, because you covered that such impactful, historic, awesome, fun, positive time in Chicago sports history and NBA history. And now it just kind of has this like tainted feel to it 25 years later. So that it's an unsettling feeling. I'm in touch with a lot of those guys from those teams. I'm not surprised any of this is happening. And I've talked to players from those teams who have the same feeling. It's like unsettling, you know. I have not talked to Scottie in a while, so I don't want to say too much until I get a chance to speak with him. I will say that particularly that season where he came back 03-04, which I guess now he's mad at John for, was actually one of my favorite seasons ever to be around him, because the Bulls weren't very good and he was like in authority, you know, like basketball sage mode. And I just sat around the locker room and learned a boatload about basketball from Scottie Pippen. So I've always enjoyed covering Scottie and being around him, but I don't know, man, it's like, what do we got to be angry about? You know, it's like you guys all made a lot of money and won 6 championships, which is really damn hard to do. And I guess, you know, everyone's got to do what they got to do in life, but I just, you said off the air, or maybe you said on the air, I'm a little more cheerful than most. So I don't like the vibe I'm getting from it. And it's probably going to get worse as the book comes out and more excerpts come out. So when I read it, you can text me and then you can read my response on the air. Mm-hmm.
I think the lesson here is we should never reflect back on time. No documentaries. Let things be. If you won a bunch of championships and everybody was happy, we just let it be. Everybody be happy about it. Like going and digging it all up and stirring it all up, it just makes people unhappy. Well, no more documentaries.
I will say this, because he said this on the record with me on a podcast I had on NBC Sports Chicago. Bill Cartwright, and I can do a pretty good Bill impersonation. He's like, is it just me or did we win 6 freaking titles? It's like, I mean, that's it. It's like, I get it. There's like ego and money and jealousies and locker room stuff involved. I get all that. But 25 years later, can't you just be happy you won 6 championships? That's really hard to do.
Hey, I'm waiting for like Mario Chalmers' unauthorized Heat documentary from 2011. Like, that'll be the next, like 20 years from now, like Mario Chalmers will rock the boat with his version of events that happened with Miami back in the day. Casey, we appreciate it, man. Enjoy Philadelphia. If you are walking down JFK Boulevard, you might spot a bar there and like ask them if they knew they saw me and Tim Bontemps there double fisting for much of last night, because that was the evening down there. So check it out.
I will go check it out. Thanks for having me on, guys.
All right, Howard, let's turn to the team that Chicago beat on Monday night, the wayward Boston Celtics, who have not only been bad, they have been unenergetic, for lack of a better word, lackadaisical. They have been dysfunctional, where you have the coach calling out the players early on, Marcus Smart calling out the coach for the way he's playing him, Marcus Smart calling out the two stars, Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown. Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum declining to speak with the media, which is a separate conversation, after the loss to Chicago, not really showing any accountability in that regard. This is a team, Howard, that, if not for a fourth quarter comeback against Charlotte and the hapless Houston Rockets, they could easily not have a win this season. Their 3 home games, they have been booed in each of every one of them by, at various points by, excuse me, the home crowd. So what's your take on what you've seen. I've early in Boston. I've got some opinions here, but I want you to go first. What's your take on what you've seen from the Celtics?
I'll say this. When we were, you know, getting notes together, preparing for the podcast earlier in the afternoon, and I went on Twitter at one point and I saw Brad Stevens trending. That's never good. You don't want to be the G. If the GM is trending, it can't possibly be a good thing. And actually, it was funny because I just thought it was, oh, people are just are you know, going to be screaming about Brad Stevens and moves he made, moves he didn't make, or whatever, or moves they want him to make. But no, it was actually twofold. It was Brad Stevens has either screwed up the team either as the coach previously and now that they can't be fixed, or as the GM now, or it's because Ime Udoka is showing he is no Brad Stevens, in which case now it's still a Brad Stevens problem because he hired Ime Udoka. And it's every which way you slice this thing, it's a problem. Let me start with Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum, because I have been saying for the last few years, my optimism about the Celtics or my belief in the Celtics as a potential contender in the East, whether it was the Isaiah Thomas version, whether it was the Kyrie Irving version, short-lived as it was, whether it was the Kemba Walker, my belief in that franchise and their potential was because I thought those two, Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum, could be or should be the best 1-2 punch at the wings in the NBA. Maybe not the best all-star duo. There are some others out there, obviously, that are more accomplished. But as two young wings that could grow together and could do a lot of damage at both ends of the court and were showing steady improvement, I thought the sky's the limit for this franchise. And last season was easy to brush off as, you know what? There's some COVID issues. It's a weird season. They underachieved a little bit. They'll bounce back. Well, here we are in year whatever it is now. And that partnership, to me, from the outside, and you see it a lot more closely than I do in Boston, Chris, but that's never looked more fragile to me. And both guys refusing to meet with the media also speaks to a certain fragility. And before listeners or anybody else think, you guys just get mad when guys don't want to talk to you. No, it's not about that. One, the job of interviewing guys is to tell you, the NBA fans, the fans of a specific team or the listeners, the readers, what is on these guys' minds. What went right, what went wrong, whatever. That's just the job. This is for you. It's not for us. It's not about my ego. I don't care. And I wasn't there the other night. But it's about that, but it's also about accountability. Because when you're the stars of the team, when you're making the most money, when you get the most shots, when you get the most spotlight, when you get the most credit for the wins, you have a responsibility that goes with that. And that's not a responsibility to me. It's to your teammates and to your franchise. Because when you don't talk, that means it's going to be Marcus Smart and Dennis Schroeder and the rest that have to explain the loss instead when you took the most shots, Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown, and you make the most money, Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown.
By the way, Howard, before you continue, like two things. One, like they are supposed to talk, like they're mandated to talk. Like this is another NBA thing that drives me crazy. Like the NBA has rules on this. And
yes.
Just because of COVID, they're allowed to kind of hide in the locker room and not speak. So that's one. The NBA, which has become a little bit too player-friendly in my mind when it comes to media.
There's a contractual obligation.
There is. And the NBA never enforces it. I mean, Adam Silver's done some great things, but the way he kind of coddles players does bother me. That's number one. Number two, to your point on accountability. Like, look at recent examples where the day that Ben Simmons was thrown out of practice, who was up there speaking with the 76ers? Joel Embiid, the star, the face of the team, the face of the franchise. He was up there speaking for Philadelphia. Last night, Damian Lillard had another bad shooting night. The Blazers lost a brutal game to a team without Embiid, without Tobias Harris, without Ben Simmons. But you know who was there? Damian Lillard up front, taking questions, taking some pointed questions too from some reporters there about the Blazers' performance. If you're a star and you want to be a star, part of it is to be accountable for what's happening within your team. Continue.
No doubt. Absolutely. So I sidetracked just a little bit there, but it is part of it too. And it does speak to mindset of these stars. It speaks to team culture to some extent and accountability. So it is part of the basketball part of it. But let me talk about the basketball part too here. Tatum and Brown are too talented for them to be this bad. Which to me, if you have guys of that caliber, and listen, it's not the greatest supporting cast, let's be honest. Not, whether it was Danny Ainge the last couple of years, or whether it's Brad Stevens now, they have not done a spectacular job in building up the supporting cast around them. They need a real point guard. I like Marcus Smart a lot. I think we both like what Marcus Smart does. But he's not the guy you want as your primary point guard. And Dennis Schroeder, for all of his talents, again, he's more of a combo guard off the bench. He's not a guy you want running the offense all the time or entrusting with making sure everybody's in their proper places and everybody's getting their touch. That's not who either of these guys are. So they don't have a point guard. So that's on the franchise. But Brown and Tatum, these are two guys who could do a lot with the ball in their hands. And unfortunately, it seems like they're just doing that as solo acts. They're not operating well together. They're not operating well in the context of their overall team. Tatum is leading the league right now in field goal attempts and with a career high 24.6 a game. He's at a career high in usage rate at 32.6, but coupled with a career worst true shooting percentage, which is below 500 right now. He's at 479 in true shooting. That's terrible.
A lot of your turn, my turn with those two guys right now.
Yes. And so when that happens, Chris, not always, but often that is speaking to a deeper issue. If guys aren't cooperating, if your two stars aren't cooperating well with each other and aren't cooperating well with the supporting cast around them and their usage rate is up and their assists are down and there's just not, it doesn't feel integrated, that usually speaks to a bigger problem. And that's what Marcus Smart spoke to when he said, you know, these guys don't want to pass the ball. I'm glad he said that out loud. I'm glad he told us in the public that, because it's clearly on the minds of the Celtics. And it's clearly a problem. And it's one thing for us to observe it and wonder about how big of an issue that is. But when it's one of your key players bringing it up, I think that validates our perceptions. We can understand it. Yeah, they have a chemistry problem. As much of a basketball problem or anything else, we can talk about tactical stuff. We can talk about the roster construction. They have a chemistry problem.
They do. They've got several problems. One of them is a chemistry problem. Another is, as you say, the lack of a traditional playmaker, which I said over and over again before the start of the season. Like, Kemba Walker may have been damaged goods, but for the better part of the last decade, the Celtics have had a lead point guard in place. Isaiah, Kyrie, Kemba, last couple of years. Marcus Smart is tremendously good at many things, but he has never been that lead playmaker, and that is a valuable position to have. And when you don't have that guy, you need Tatum and Brown to be playmakers, and to this point, they have not been that. That's number one. Another thing I look at with the Celtics, they're 27th in the NBA in defense. How is that possible? Look at that team. That is a team with some very, very good individual defenders. Marcus Smart is a perennial member of the all-defensive team. Dennis Schroeder, I get some Lakers fans tweeting at me when I say this, but Dennis Schroeder is a good defensive player. He is a good defensive player. Josh Richardson has been a good defensive player over his career. Jaylen Brown has been a good defensive player. Jason Tatum, last couple of years, has taken strides on the defensive end, especially when it comes to deflection, steals, things like that. That's been an improvement for him. Al Horford has been part of very good defensive teams. Rob Williams, before his injury issue, was leading the NBA in shot blocking. So you have all these individual players who are good defensive players, and you're 27th in the league in defense. I don't get that. I don't get how that's possible. So whether that's schemes, whether that's energy, effort, which are all kind of interconnected, that is one of, if not the biggest problem the Celtics have. Now, let me turn to Udoka for a second. And I don't think a coach should be judged on 7 games to his first season. Like, you know, we got to give the guy some time.
Especially as a rookie head coach, yeah.
100%, right? You got to give him some time to figure it out. If I'm going to make one critique of Ime Udoka right now, is that he is way too overly reliant on his veteran players and not giving a shot to his younger players. Now, maybe that comes from a guy that's come up the ranks, you know, in San Antonio, where they were very veteran-heavy. Brooklyn last year, of course, veteran-heavy. Did have that time in Philadelphia, a lot of young guys there. But he is leaning heavily on his veteran players. I look at the minutes played, Howard, of some of the young guys on this team. You've got Romeo Langford, 17 minutes a game. Peyton Pritchard, 13 minutes a game. Aaron Nesmith, who's only played in 4 games, 7 minutes a game. These guys got to play. I mean, there was the game in Washington on, I believe it was Saturday, where I think the Celtics didn't make a 3 to like the 3rd quarter. And Aaron Nesmith is stapled to the bench. Like, that's a guy that can make shots. Maybe give him a whirl and don't play Josh Richardson quite as many minutes. It just doesn't seem like Udoka's comfortable going with young players, probably because young players have a habit of making mistakes. But in my mind, you can tell me what you think. Like, this is the time to get those mistakes out of their system. Like, this is the time to play Romeo Langford, who can shoot the ball and can defend, to play him more minutes than Josh Richardson, to give Aaron Nesmith opportunity to play himself into the rotation. I even want to see Grant Williams play a little bit more. I mean, Grant Williams has really worked himself into becoming a respectable three-point shooter. I'd like to see him more in the rotation, that 4-5 slot. Like, it just strikes me that Udoka is way too focused on playing the veterans and not as focused as he should be about burning out the young guys.
I think that's all fair. And I agree, too, that early in the season, you kind of want to use the opportunity to experiment a little bit or see what your guys have before you decide, this is a low rotation or non-rotation player. At the same time, though, look, they did underachieve last season. He is a rookie head coach, Ime Udoka. They are under some pressure to show that they are better than what they displayed last season. And as a new head coach, you want to make a quick impression too. So yeah, I think it's natural. It may not be the right thing long term, but it's natural to want to rely on veterans who you trust more and who have a longer track record than to experiment with youth too soon. Chris, I still think the bigger issue, though, is that there just aren't that many options there, period. I mean, As we've both said, you don't have a real point guard to pull this whole thing together. So you already don't have a unifying force, right? Sometimes your unifying force is just simply who your star is, right? But especially if your star is being a little selfish, you do need somebody to rein them in, and you need a strong point guard with a point guard mentality to do that. So they don't have that. A lot of this, I think, is a roster construction issue. And I don't want to put it all at the feet of Brad Stevens, because he's only been on the job as GM, team president, whatever title they gave him, for, what, 4 months?
Right. Standing Angels team still.
Largely. But still, if you were going to part ways with your entire... By the way, their entire backcourt that Brad coached and then inherited is doing pretty well in New York. Kemba and Evan Fournier are looking pretty nice for the Knicks.
I mean, not to go too far off topic, because we're going to get to the Knicks, but, like, you know, Kemba's shooting the lights out of the three, and Fournier has been as advertised offensively. So the Fournier one has always struck me as weird. Like, the contract with New York wasn't that bad. Like, it wasn't a bad contract that he signed there. Like, why not bring him back to give yourself some firepower?
And so the better the Knicks do with that backcourt, the better Kemba and Fournier look. And granted, listen, Kemba was on a different contract with Boston, right? They trade him away, and then he gets bought out. So it's not the same exact math or financial responsibility, but Kemba's still an effective player. Now, if his knees go over the course of the season and the Knicks come to regret it, the Celtics might sit there and say, hey, look, now you see why we didn't want to continue that investment. I get it. But as of right now, the Celtics look really bad. Their starting backcourt is now in New York, and the Knicks are among the top teams in the East, and the Celtics are dragging. So that's on Brad Stevens. But it's also on him to not have found a replacement. If you're going to ship out Kemba, you needed a plan for how to replace him. So, you know, Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown, it will still be about them in large part because they are the stars. But they are younger stars. They are still finding their way. And the responsibilities that come with being a star in this league, in involving your teammates, in leading the right way, in understanding that it's not just about your talent. And about how to trust your teammates. Like, those are lessons every star in this league needs to learn. And some learn it later than others. Some never learn it. So I think some patience is probably warranted. I understand that in Boston there will be no patience. So
no, there will not be any patience. But you're right. It is warranted at least more than 7 games worth of patience. One last thing on Tatum.
I have a question for you before we leave the Celtics also.
All right, let me just say this about Tatum. Tatum's got to leave the referees alone. He is spending a lot of time demonstrably complaining to referees. And there's a couple of clips floating around there on Twitter where one time against, I think it was Washington, he didn't get back fast enough and his guy scored in transition. Like, not only does he have to leave the referees alone, Howard, it should be known that many of the times that he's complaining about foul calls, they're not fouls. And I'm not even talking about the James Harden stuff where they're not calling anymore. These are traditional, he's not getting bumped enough to warrant a foul call, and he's just griping. And that's a problem. He's got to get the complaints down and the free throw attempts up. He's shooting about 5 free throws per game this year. I thought coming into the season, he could get to 10. That's got to be his focus. He can't be complaining as much as he is to the referees. Go ahead. You have a question.
So here's the question, because, again, you're closer to this team than I am. I have never, not when it was a Bradley Beal rumor or any other rumors, I've never thought that it would be a wise move to break up Tatum and Brown. But the sign, there are these warning signs, right? Their assists are both down. As we talked about, they're not working well with each other, not working well with their surroundings. Is this the moment where they actually have to seriously consider whether the best move forward is not about how you supplement those two, but maybe whether or not you need to break up those two? Are we at that point?
Not for me, because especially, well, first, you want to give them months, not weeks, with this new coach, this new system, and time to figure it out. And Jaylen Brown, despite the fact that he got off the couch and went for 46 against the Knicks in the season opener, missed a huge chunk of the preseason with COVID and is still kind of getting through all that. I'm still a big believer in Jaylen Brown. I've said this on this podcast before, like every year, almost every year in the league, he has gotten better. He became a near 40% three-point shooter last year. He became an all-star last season. I just have to believe that arc is going to continue to trend upward and not flatten or go down. So I need, you know, into January before I start even remotely considering that as a possibility. All right, another team we'll be talking about in January, I'm sure, is the Portland Trail Blazers. As I said, I was in Philly on Monday to watch the Blazers against the Sixers. Not a good loss for the Blazers. Philadelphia was down Ben Simmons, of course, also Joel Embiid, Tobias Harris. Danny Green went out at halftime with a hamstring issue, and George Niang, Seth Curry, Tyrese Maxey just busted up the Portland Trail Blazers. Damian Lillard's shooting problems continued in that one. He's shooting, I think, at the 20% from three-point range around there, maybe a little bit less. Right, I have to double-check the stats. I've got some thoughts on this as well, but give me your early read on Portland, which dropped back-to-back road games and now sits at 3-4 to start the season.
I'm at a loss on this one, to be honest. Like, I know that the point of a podcast is that we share our impressions.
Have a take.
Just to have a take. The Blazers have, seriously, they've got me completely flummoxed. And I know there's some part of the fan base out there that's probably thinking, no, the Blazers have been struggling and they're just struggling more. And no, the Blazers kind of underachieved last year and they had injuries again, right? My feeling about this team has simply been, okay, they did not do enough to improve. They're not a contender in the West. But we know there's a certain baseline that they can always reach with Lillard and McCollum healthy and firing on all cylinders. And if Nurkic could stay healthy, all of our ifs about all their health issues they've had over the last couple of years. Well, they're healthy right now. They're healthy. Anthony Simons, after three, 4 straight years of Anthony Simons is going to be the next big thing, actually is starting to break out. He's playing pretty well.
He looks good. He's a bright spot with that team. He's got a little bit of man strength to him and some real polish to his game.
He's looking good, and McCollum's off to a strong start. And yet Damian Lillard himself is the one who's now, like, if we were going to say as a theoretical exercise a month ago, hey, a few weeks into the season, the Blazers are going to be really messed up. What do you think will be, on Dame Lillard's mind? We'd be like, oh, well, his teammates are failing him again. He's going to want to trade. No, he's the only one failing right now. Damian Lillard's at a career low as we speak. Career low in points per game, 18.6. Career low in field goal percentage at 35%. Career low in three-point percentage at 23. I mean, he's in Russell Westbrook three-point range. Career low in free throw attempts per game, 3.9. His assists are up. So he's at least, passing the ball well. But I don't know what to make of this, Chris, because there's no injury that we are aware of. And the only other answer would be, is it a mental issue to do with his discontent with the Blazers that he has somehow been papering over this whole time? Because he has said all the right things ever since the summer about, I want to be here. I'm here to stay. I'm going to be the one to help, we're going to turn this thing around and I'm sticking it out. I don't want to be traded. I'm not demanding a trade. I'm rebutting every trade rumor and report out there about what I want. And so, okay, I believe him. I believed him then. I believe him now. But when he's playing this poorly, you have to wonder, like, what is on his mind that is causing one of the greatest offensive players in the league, one of the great clutch shooters in the league, one of the great three-point shooters in the league, to be this far below expectations on just about everything. I don't know where to begin.
Well, I know where to begin with the team, and that's defense, because that was the theme of last year, and it's once again a theme this year. They are bottom third in the NBA in defensive efficiency. Now, they haven't been as consistently bad as they were last year, but they're still not good. And they gave up .113 against the Sixers. That's not a terrible number, but it is when you throw in who the Sixers had out there on the floor. And the Sixers had no expectation of winning that game based on who was available to them. I am not the least bit worried about Damian Lillard, like, at the player. Like, Lillard, you know, talking to him last night, his body feels fine. The shots he's getting are good. Like, these are good looks. He's not having trouble finding open space. They're just not falling right now. And maybe that's a product of Chauncey Billups, a new system, but you've got a player that is a proven scorer in this league. He will be a scorer once again. Damian Lillard is a great offensive player. The defense, though, is troublesome. Like, you know, Neil Olshey, the GM, went out of his way to say it wasn't a personnel issue with this team defensively. I'm sorry, it was and it is. Like, they added some decent defenders. Larry Nance Jr. is a good defensive player. Cody Zeller, a nice backup at that spot. But in crunch time of the game last night, this team went four guards: Norman Powell, Damian Lillard, CJ McCollum, and Anthony Simons, with Jusuf Nurkić in the middle. That is not a team that's going to get stops. It's not.
No.
So I don't know how you correct the defensive struggles to make this team anything more than nominally better what it was in the years past. And that leads to the question, is Damian Lillard okay with that? Like, it's one thing to be okay with it now, seven games into the season, early November. What happens if we hit January and the Blazers look more like a play-in team than they do a team competing for a top four seed in the Eastern Conference? That's the great unknowable. Like, Lillard, you know, they were chanting, "We want Lillard," last night in Philadelphia, though I should point out it was a pretty pathetic chant. Like, it was kind of an anemic one, even though it, like, got all over Twitter. Lillard said the right things afterwards. He said, "City
got all over Twitter because you tweeted it."
I did tweet it, yeah, I did. But others did, too. It was a thing. You know, but he reiterated, I'm a Blazer, 10 toes in Rip City, you know, once again reiterating that he wants to be in Portland. And I believe him. Because Damian Lillard, if nothing else, is authentic. What Damian Lillard says at press conferences, he feels. Like, I don't get a sense ever that he's holding something back at these press availabilities. So, I just wonder, does that attitude change in January if this team's in the exact same place, playing 500 basketball, where the defense is not cracking the top half of the league, which would enable them to be a contender?
And I don't know what changes here. I mean, there's no reason for us to believe, based on their personnel, that the defense is going to get substantially better. There's only so much you can do with schemes, effort, whatever you want to call it. I mean, I agree.
You can't scheme your way to.
The Knicks kind of did, right? Like, Tibbs, you know, like,
the Heat willed. Do too. I guess, you know, the Heat, I mean, the Heat have got some really good defenders, but they're also rolling Duncan Robinson out there, Tyler Hero, some other guys that are.
Yeah, but between Butler and Adebayo,
the Knicks are a better example.
Yeah. The Knicks are a better example of where a coach can make a difference. On the other hand, as I've pointed out before, and I will again because it's relevant, Tibbs could not make that same difference in Minnesota, and they were always bottom third. I think there is a limit to how much a defense, whether it's scheme or whether it's coach and emphasis and whatever, there is a limit. You have to have defensive players and the right personnel. The Blazers do not. And so I don't know how much, you know, Chauncey Billups as a rookie head coach there can change that. We'll see over the course of weeks. It's too soon to say. We do know this much. They're going nowhere and have no shot whatsoever at being a good team if Lillard is playing like this. Like, that's a no-brainer. So if Lillard snaps out of his funk, they'll at least be a respectable competitive team, as they've been. They can be below average defensively and still be pretty good. We've seen it before. They have the template for that. As it, you know, there's a ceiling on it, but we know they can do that much. But Lillard has to be Lillard again. And to me, that's the biggest mystery of this early season.
Yeah, but it's a mystery that will be solved. Like, maybe by the time some people listen to this podcast, or maybe by the time that we get to the next one next week, he might have gone on a tear where he's, shooting like 60% from three. Like, he's just that good. Like, I'm not worried about that. I just think the defense is always going to limit them and always going to create a short ceiling for where this team can go. And I wonder how Lillard feels about that in January, early February, when it comes time to talk potential deals. Finally, Howard, let's discuss the Knicks. I told you weeks ago, I told everyone weeks ago, when Vegas put the Knicks odds at 41.5, that's free money. Free money.
You're so mad at Vegas. Wins.
I'm so mad at Vegas, because Vegas at least make me think sometimes. Like, that didn't make me think. Like, the idea that the Knicks were going to have almost as many wins in a 72-game season as they would an 82-game season never jibed with me. Like, did Vegas think the Eastern Conference got better? Sure, it did. Did Vegas think Julius Randle wasn't going to play at the same level? Maybe. Maybe it did. But Julius Randle is playing at that level. And the young guys on that Knicks team, they got better too. Like, they're better. Look at RJ Barrett. He's shooting like 43% from three-point range. Howard, I'm old enough to remember when RJ Barrett couldn't shoot. When everyone's like, oh, RJ Barrett's going to be like a straight line drive guy, and, you know, he'll have a decent offensive career, but he won't be a perimeter threat. 40-plus percent from three-point range. Ready to talk about RJ Barrett being better than Zion? We have that conversation?
No, we're not.
For the record, do not aggregate that. We are not talking about that just yet. But the Knicks have Barrett playing better. They have got Emmanuel Quickley playing well with that team. They have got Mitchell Robinson is back in the rotation once again. And the guys they signed, who we mentioned before, Evan Fournier, Kemba Walker, they have contributed to this team. Like, we just sang the praises of Tibbs as the Knicks coach. Defensively, they're not playing good defense right now, at least not statistically. They are 19th in the NBA in defensive efficiency. They're able to counter it by being top three in the NBA in offensive efficiency. I don't know how far down the offense is going to dip, but I guarantee you the defense is going to improve as the season goes on. That's just a Tibbs hallmark. So, like, I'm bullish on the Knicks, man. That is a top five seed in the Eastern Conference that's going to win 45 to 46 games. Vegas, you are stupid. You blew it. And if you didn't take my advice several weeks ago, when I put this out there, start listening to your boy. Start listening to your boy.
Let me just make clear to the listeners that if you're taking gambling advice from either of us, you are stupid as Mannix thinks Vegas is. Secondarily, you will not be hearing gambling advice from me ever anyway.
For me. I'm all about that.
This is purely for entertainment purposes, people.
Should have bet the Knicks.
Look, the Knicks is a top five team. Like, it's possible, it's plausible, and they might even do it. I still think that when push comes to shove, or when we get deeper into the season, we know that Brooklyn and Milwaukee will be up there. We're pretty sure that you know, these two teams that are, like, you know, screwing around in the bottom half of the East, Milwaukee and Brooklyn will be there. And I still think Atlanta and Miami are the other two teams that I would put in the likely top four. Could the Knicks then slot in at five? Sure. Especially with Boston apparently just deciding they're not going to be part of this discussion anymore.
Again, not to go back this up, that was predictable. I'm sorry. But Howard, you're saying, like, the top five, like, if I'm going to bet on sustainability between, like, the Knicks and Bulls, I'm taking the Knicks as the more sustainable contender that can stay in that top five.
So the interesting thing with the Knicks right now is that they're completely inverted of where they were last year. So last season, they finished fourth in defensive efficiency, 22nd in offense. They went out and got themselves a new backcourt in Kemba Walker and Evan Fournier. Thank you, Boston. And now they are third in offensive efficiency. And when I looked, you said 19th. I think they're at 20th defensively. But whatever. In this range of being
so
exactly...
Sorry. So sorry to be off by one place.
It's the same general vicinity. It's fine. The bottom line is that they flipped. They flipped. They went from elite defense and meh offense to elite offense through seven games, wherever we are, and meh defense, which is not the Tibbs way, clearly. It's also early in the season, right? Like, they took double overtime to beat the Celtics. They've got quality wins against the Bulls and Sixers, if you believe in the Bulls in the first place, which I'm still skeptical on. They lost to Orlando, which was heinous. They lost to Toronto, which wasn't great, especially when Toronto was missing a couple players. Like, it's hey, still
Toronto
kind of a mixed
hard,
bag.
Though. Toronto plays hard, man.
They play their butts off, but a lot of that has also
Scotty Barnes is making...
Right, and Barnes didn't play in that game.
Myself, yeah. Well, you're right. I'm just saying in general, the Raptors, like Scottie Barnes, yes. Separate conversation, yes. Looks like Scottie Pippen out there half the time. So that's we'll yes. Do that another podcast.
A much happier version of Scottie Pippen.
Correct.
I'm not placing a lot of stock in anybody's season to date because that's just, I don't do that. But I think there's a little bit of like Randall's numbers are down a little bit, but he's probably adjusting to Kemba and even Fournier taking on more offensive roles than, say, Elfrid Payton, who was a non-offensive player, and Reggie Bullock, who was a spot-up three-point shooter. So Randall's in a bit of an adjustment period. RJ Barrett looks like he's made another, like, mini leap. His three-point percentage is up. His two-point percentage is up. His defense is really strong. He's talking about wanting to make all-defensive team, and he's backing it up. So there's a lot...
Really good.
There's
really
a lot good. About what they're doing that's absolutely legitimate and tangible, and I think sustainable in the abstract. Whether that results in them being able to crash the top four in the East, I think is very much an open question. I'm curious to see where it all evens out, right? Like, they're not going to finish probably with the third best offense. They're certainly not going to finish with the 20th best defense. So where do those two finally even out, right? And can they be top 10 in both? Because the offense has improved enough that I think that that's on the table. That they've got enough weapons now, better weapons than they had last year offensively, especially just guys who can create. They could potentially put together a top 10 offense, and if they can get their defense back to where it was, well, hell, then that's the profile of an elite team.
Yeah, I don't look. This isn't an argument for the Knicks as a deep playoff run contender because that's a separate conversation. You know, but the Knicks always play hard. Like under Tibbs, they always play hard, and that can manufacture you some wins in today's NBA where not every team plays hard. I mean, we just discussed the Celtics. One of their biggest problems is that they don't play hard every single night. Portland, they don't play hard, at least the games that I've seen every single night. So by playing hard every night, you'll steal some wins in this league. And those wins, I think, will put you inside that top five. And I'm looking forward to hearing Bing Bong in the playoffs. That's a great addition to the music of New York, the sound of the train picking you
it's,
up.
It's, by, not been to it's by far the best organic team slogan that's come along in New York or anywhere else in a long time.
I'm honestly surprised it was never before.
We'll be sick of it by the end of the season, but right now it's really funny and a lot of
fun. Bing bong! I'm ready for more. Howard, we'll do it again next week.
Always a pleasure, my friend.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.